All right, as we get underway this morning, I do want to offer a quick recap of a couple of things. And I do this in part so as we one day get to the conclusion of the study, you can walk away with at least a couple things I think that will be helpful for a long time. We have said as we go through the book of Revelation, the approach that I'm taking is that we have a book that's filled with symbols. And as we look at these symbols, we really find information that is stated elsewhere in the New Testament. Revelation is not a book that has a lot of new stuff. It's stuff that we've already learned over the years and is just being presented in a much different way. That, to me, is helpful information, especially as we look at Revelation 13, the last three or four verses where John talks about the mark of the beast and 666 and all these other things. One of the things, I wish I would have spent a little more time on this in Revelation 13, 15, but we will develop it a little bit more as we get into Revelation 14. We'll probably say some introductory things. Offer some introductory comments in Revelation 14, maybe today, and then certainly next week's class. But as we think about the beast in Revelation 13, the first beast, remember, John pictures it as coming up out of the sea, and we said that first beast stands for, anybody recall? Our evil civil authority, which would have been for those in John's day, the Roman Empire. And then we have that second beast that John sees, the land beast, and that's coming from where? Or what is it? All right, it's going to be apostate religion, and that's been Satan's two greatest allies over the years. He's been able to use corrupt civil government, evil civil government, and he's been able to use apostate religion to further his causes. And John is talking about, as we get down to the end of Revelation 13, some information especially about that first beast, evil civil authority. As I was thinking through some of this, I thought, don't we have something in our day and time, especially right now, that's a good example of that evil civil authority that's putting the whammy on Christians in some respects. All right, you think about same-sex marriage. The world, and you know, it's not so much from the government right now as far as they're going to persecute you, they're going to put you in jail, or they're going to kill you. We're not to that point. But we are seeing more and more as far as civil authority, what it's doing with same-sex marriage, and if Christians are not willing to accept that, how are they regarded? All right, yeah, you are a hater, you are someone who's unloving, you are someone who's intolerant, you're a person who's very judgmental, all these kinds of things. Well, what we're seeing today, we can link it back to the principle that we have here in Revelation 13 and Revelation 14 and elsewhere. It's really the same principle. Remember in Acts 5, verse 29, Peter and the apostles said we've got to obey God rather than man. Everybody's familiar with Acts 5, and probably in the next couple weeks, we'll go back and look at that principle. But that principle is also seen in the book of Revelation, where John is saying, you can either submit to whom? You can submit to the beast, and you can have his mark. Or you can submit to God, and you can bear his stamp. Well, that's the same choice we have to make today, isn't it? When it comes to same-sex marriage, we can accept the mark of the beast. That is, we can submit to what evil civil authority wants us to do. Or we can try to stand against the tide and we can say we're going to stand for God and his word. So the choice that we're making today, it is not new. It's been going on for a long, long time. And when we look at this information in Revelation chapter 13, we can make it very practical. All right, anything that you want to add or ask over those introductory comments? Okay. Revelation 13, let's pick up with that final verse, and this is where we're going to spend our time today. John says, well, let's let's go back and read 15 through 17 to kind of get the context as well. And it was given unto him to give life to it, even to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as should not worship the beast. That would be the faithful Christians who are not going to do what evil civil authority wanted them to do. They should not worship the image of the beast. They were going to be killed. And 16 says, and he that causeth all, the small, the great, the rich, the poor, the free, the bond, that there should be given them a mark on their right hand or upon their forehead. And that no man should be able to buy or sell, save he that hath the mark, even the name of the beast or the number of the name. And then 18, here is wisdom. He that hath understanding, let him count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. When you look at it, verses 17 and 18, and you can see more of this in the Greek text, but you can still see plenty, I think, in the English text that you have. He says that no man should be able to buy or sell, save he that has. Well, what would you say about the tense there? He that has, is that past? Is that present? Is that future? Well, or half, or has a present. It's not future. So when John's writing this 2,000 years ago, he talks about the mark of the beast, and he says, he that has it. Well, what's that tell us about this particular mark? Past, present, or future? All right, it was something that was affecting people in John's day and time. If you can remember nothing else about the mark of the beast, make a note of the present tense. And that will help you as people, you know, talk about, well, today the mark of the beast is coming up. And then you find in verse 18, also the present tense. Here's wisdom. He that has, present tense for his people, let him count the number of the beast, for it is, not will be. A lot of people read this verse in such a way where it's going to be. It is 2,000 years ago. In fact, if you were to look at the Greek text for verses 17 and 18, you'd find that about six times John uses the present tense here. So very, very helpful information as far as trying to show that this is not something that's going to occur in our day and time as far as some kind of specific prophecy by John or something that's going to happen excuse me, in the future. But there are these evil forces that we talked about, Revelation 13. We have Satan using evil civil authority to further his purposes. We also have him using false religion. He's been doing that for a long, long time. So we can, as we mentioned at the beginning of the class, apply this information in a general way. Our job, if you skip across the page a little bit, Revelation chapter 14, verse 12, over there, John said, here is the patience of the saints that they do what? They keep the commandments of God. As Satan is out there working in the world, trying to do all kinds of evil things, God says to his people, you know, the devil's busy, but what do you need to do? You need to be obedient to me. You need to keep the commandments. Wasn't this how John began the book? Revelation chapter 1, verse 3, he talked about keeping, doing the commandments of God. This is the way that God's people have, you know, been obligated to live ever since Christianity was instituted. But we have a lot of people, and we'll see this in Revelation chapter 14, verses 8 through 10. John's going to talk about the fall of Babylon, or false religion, in Revelation 14, verse 8. And then there's some information in verse 9. If any man, Revelation 14, worships the beast in his image, if he receives the mark, then look at verse 10 to kind of give you a preview of what's coming. He's going to drink the what? The wine of the wrath of God, which is prepared, it's unmixed, in the cup of his anger. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone. What's that sound like? Hell. So, John says, if you are willing to submit yourselves to that false evil authority, civil government, and the sinful things that they want you to do, what's going to be the consequence? You're going to end up in hell. You know, you can't please God and serve the world. But if you're willing to stand against the tide of what comes, you know, your way as far as evil civil authority and false religion, you're going to be blessed. You're going to have the mark of God. So, once again, it is the same stuff that we see elsewhere in the world. Paul, remember Romans 12, verse 2? He said, and be not fashioned according to this world, but be what? But be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. It's the same message that we have in Revelation 13 and Revelation 14. It is just described in much different language. Okay, latter part of this verse, John speaks about the number of the beast. He also talks about the number of a man, and then uses the figure 666. We talked about, way back when in our study on numerology, the number 6. Anybody remember what the number 6 stands for, represents? Okay, it stands for things that are not good, evil. 7, of course, is that divine number, that perfection number, that number of completeness. You subtract one from that, and now you have something that's short of completeness. We talked about Goliath. If you go back and you look at Goliath, we have the measurements for this guy. And the measurements, we would suggest, since he typified the enemy of God's people, those measurements associated with him are largely tied with the number 6. For example, we find that he was 6 cubits tall. How many pieces of armor do you think he had? All right, he had 6 pieces of armament. We also find that he had a spear that weighed how many shekels? Well, 600. So we've got the number there, 6, being once again used for that. And then if you were to look at some other passages, that's in 1 Samuel 17, verses 4 through 6, we have some information about Nebuchadnezzar. You remember what Nebuchadnezzar did? He was that fellow that set something up. What did he set up? That statue? And what were people supposed to do with that statue? Worship it, right? Apostate worship under Nebuchadnezzar. The image, if you go back and you look at it, it was 60 cubits tall, 6 cubits wide. And there were instruments of music that were played to, you know, bring to people's attention, it's time to worship this false image. Anybody want to take a stab at how many instruments were used? Six. So in the Old Testament, when you're dealing with Nebuchadnezzar, that image, when you're dealing with Goliath, and we could probably come up with some other examples, this number keeps coming up. Six, 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 six. The information for Nebuchadnezzar would be in Daniel chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. So when John talks about here, 666, we, in our study of numerology, said if a person likes some food, he might say, well, that was good. If he really likes the food, he will say, very good. But if he's really enthused, he might say, that was really, really, really good. By, you know, it's the same thing with love. I love you. I really love you. I really, really, really love you. It's a way of emphasizing things. So when we have that six, and it is tripled, it's a way of describing God's enemies, a spiritual adversary that's very evil, very corrupt. I mean, this is about as bad as it gets. Anything that you might add or ask before we kind of move into another thought? Okay. As we look at time, people have made a lot of suggestions as far as what the number 666 refers to. Some have said it refers to an individual. As far as Roman emperors, some have suggested that it refers to Nero. Others think that it refers to another really cruel emperor. That would have been Domitian. In more modern times, some have said, well, we think that it refers to Muhammad. Other suggestions were Martin Luther, Pope Benedict the 11th, Napoleon, Hitler, Stalin, and we would suspect that if time continues, many more guesses will be made. As we look at what John said, though, what have we already said about verses 17 and 18? What's the tense that John uses? Past, present, or future? Well, for us, it's past. But he's using the present tense in his day and time. We know that. Since John used the present tense, we would then be inclined, as we study the 666, to go back and look at that first century era and say, we would, you know, be inclined to think that John, and application for us certainly, but John had to have something in mind for his first century readers when he was thinking about this particular number. So the idea that this is going to describe some future world leader or some president and so forth, that would seem to be very, very unlikely. Let's go back and look at a couple of the passages that we've previously studied in this book. Revelation 2, Revelation 6. Who'd like to pick up for us Revelation 2, verse 13? Revelation. All right, Harvey, did you flash a hand? Oh, okay. 2:13, and Lois, since you flashed a hand as well. Revelation 6, verses 9 and 10. Harvey, if you go first. Revelation 2, verse 13.
I know thy works and where thou dwellest, even where Satan's seat is, thou holdest fast my name and hast not denied my faith. Even in those days, within Antipas was thy faithful murderer, who was slain among you where Satan dwelt.
Okay. John describes this fella and says that he was killed. You think he was killed by some chariot out there on the road? Got run over by a bunch of horses? No. Why was he killed? His life was taken because he was a faithful Christian. He was someone who was trying to serve God. As we think back to what was taking place in Rome, it was a culture. It was an empire that, by and large, was opposing God's people. Now, there were some periods where Christianity was sort of tolerated or people were not chasing God's people, at least on a national level, but there still were some local persecutions. But there were also periods where there was intense, very, very severe persecution. Here's an example of that, Revelation 2:13. All right, Lois, Revelation 6, verses 9 and 10.
And when he broke the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony which they had maintained. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, wilt thou refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth?
Here's another example. Rome is in power. People are being persecuted to the point that you have martyrdom. That's fairly common. And in Revelation 6, these people who have been killed for their faith, they're crying out, how long, God, before you take vengeance? When we look at the first century world, we have some issues in our day and time, in our nation, certainly. But when we look at the first century, we find that it was a time where many of God's people, because of Rome, they were suffering great persecution and death. Thus, when we look here at the end of Revelation 13, and John talks about this beast and the number and so forth, Once again, we have to first go back and look at Romans, say, is there anything here that could be what's related to John's particular point? And the answer to this seems to be yes. Let me make another quick point here, and we'll see which translations read one way and which translations read another. He says, let him count the number of the beast, for it is the number of, who has a man? Who has the man? It's verse 18, Revelation 13. Okay, let's try it again. I'm sorry I didn't make that clear where it was. Let him count the number of the beast, that's in the middle of the verse, for it is the number of, who has a man? Okay, at least half of us. Who has the man? Oh, okay, maybe some others are still looking for the verse. A man is a good translation. In fact, it's the right translation. What's the difference between, a man and the man? A man could be any man. The man is, in this case, Steve. But we're pointing to a particular person. All right, when John says it is the number of a man, talking about this beast and 666 and so forth, how's that different from saying it's this man? All right, he doesn't make it specific. He leaves it in a very general way. So if you have a translation which says the man, you might make a short note and say it's actually a man as far as how you would interpret the original text. One other quick point before we start to develop some ideas as far as possible interpretations. Anybody have a reference to 616 instead of 666? Or anybody ever hear of 616 instead of 666? Okay. You might have at some point somebody say, well, you know, Scott has seen that. I just bring this up in case somebody has a footnote or they've looked in a commentary or something. There are some manuscripts that do use 616 instead of 666. But the bulk of the evidence, and this seems to be the bulk in the sense, overwhelming bulk, is 666. So if you find somebody coming along and saying, well, hey, I think it may be 616. A few manuscripts that use that particular figure instead of 666, but the evidence really seems to be overwhelming as far as 666. Okay, next point. You go out, you're looking at a tree when the weather gets a little bit better, and you see something like J.R., not a great heart, but J.R., and you got a little heart, L.J. What's that mean? All right. You know, it's you've got the two initials of people, and it's a way of saying we love this particular individual. You think folks in ancient times were smart enough to figure that kind of thing out? Yeah, I mean, we sometimes look at people in the past and think, well, we're so much beyond what they were. But in some respects, they were as smart as we are, and maybe in certain respects even further along. Now, when they had this kind of thing, it was a practice that was well-known, and sometimes they also use some other things. They, in addition to things like initials, would actually take numbers. And just as kids today, you see the codes, you know, you see the little decoder rings that kids get. They're used to getting Cracker Jacks and other things. People used to do a similar thing. They would take letters, and those individual letters would be associated with numbers. In fact, and this goes back at least 3,000 years or so, there was a king, Sargon II, 727 to 707 BC. It says he built a wall 16,283 cubits long, and then he chose that number of cubits because that number of cubits corresponded to his name. And by this particular time, by the time John was writing, they had an additional practice that I'm going to demonstrate in this way. Who wants to get involved here? I'm not going to pick somebody for this. I won't embarrass you too badly. All right, Betty. All right, here's Betty. We're just going to use our alphabet. A equals 1, B equals 2, C equals 3, and D equals 4. All right, now, I don't use Betty's name, but I inscribe out in some tree B. Let's see. I put out there, or maybe I'm in the workplace. I put out a little note by the telephone, and it just says 214. Well, if we're in a culture where we're not typically using these kinds of things, we might think, well, hey, maybe that's an area code, or maybe that's a code to get into a certain part of the building. If you have key locks, sometimes in businesses they have that. But if you're from a culture where you're associating letters of the alphabet with numbers, well, let's break it down. The 2 would be a The one would be an A.
D.
Betty's bed. Well, kids today do that same kind of thing. But in the first century, this was very, very common for adults. This seems to be what we have in the book of Revelation as far as 666. The numbers are being used. And a couple of things going on. First of all, you have the six. What's that tell us? Six is a number for evil. John has tripled it. So you have this kind of thing. And then some would also suggest that, well, you know, we've got to come up with 666 somehow. So we need to see what these letters stand for. And all kinds of attempts have been made. Because, you know, kids today, each person can have their own little system as far as, you know, what numbers stand for. So unless you know exactly what system that you're working with, it's very, very difficult. The Nazis went through this. If you remember when they were trying to decode messages, wartime. You have nations, they're sending messages back and forth, and until you figure out the code, you're not going to be able to figure out the message. So they're always trying to kind of figure out how things go. And that's kind of where we are here, and I'm going to offer a suggestion. I may not be right, but this is the explanation that I prefer. Sure. Yeah. With texting, a lot of times with texting, that's probably the biggest, and with emails, sure. Right. LOL, there are all kinds of abbreviations like that. So we're still using that same kind of technology, and people have been using it for at least, like I say, 3,000 years, even rulers like Sargon II. So yes, very, very modern as far as what's being done. Now, one of the difficulties is that you have multiple languages that could be drawn from. Some will look at the Hebrew language, which I don't think is real likely, but they will say, okay, Hebrew, here are the letters, and here are what the numerical values are. Others would say, well, we think that John, he was writing this book in Greek, so we should look at the Greek letters and try to see what their numerical values are. And both of those, you can do them, and you can find all kinds of interesting things. You can make, for example, Domitian come up as far as 666, and that works out really well. You can go back and look at the various titles that he had, and as you look at the abbreviations for the titles, you can make them fit as far as 666. So there are all kinds of ways to look at various things and come up with 666. Here's the one that I prefer. I have over here, remember we've been talking about what nation, as far as the group of people that have been persecuting God's people. They're in the North Country. It's Rome. All right, so, you know, we've already gotten at least that much established. Well, about the time that John's writing this book, you know, before, a couple hundred years probably before, they had taken the Roman numerals and assigned numerical values to them. And it's interesting that out of all the Roman numerals that you have, would you like a guess? Based on what we have here, how many had numerical values associated with them? Well, seven did. Well, the others, you're right in the sense that the rest all had a numerical value of zero. But I should have phrased my question a little bit better. All the rest, but only these seven have numerical values. All right. Let's see what we have if we look at just the first six. The I stands for 1. The V stands for
5.
Next, S is 10. The L is 50. The C is 100. Very, very good. Bonnie got that one. And the M is? Very good. All right, we're with it this morning. All right, well, let's take a look at this. 1 and 5 is 6. 10 and 50?
60.
Don't mess me up. Okay. 100 and 500?
600.
600 plus 60 plus 6. Well, isn't that interesting? John takes, maybe, in my understanding of this, and like I say, this is my explanation, and others can go ahead and make a compelling explanation. So, as I said, I could be wrong in this. But at least factually, we can say this much. Seven numerals, or seven letters of the Roman alphabet, Only these seven have a numerical value greater than zero. The rest, zero. And then, interestingly enough, what have we said about that number six? Evil in the Bible. Through that sixth number, stopping right there, not listing the seven, when we look at those numerical values, we come up to 666. And then you look at this too. Six, when you add the first two, a division of six, when you add the second two, and also, in this particular case, six again. Somebody says, well, let's just for curiosity's sake, throw in the seventh number that has a numerical value beyond zero. Then what do we come up with? The M is 1,000, so if we've got 666, from the first six, we add another 1,000 to it, what do we have? 1,666. So even if you were to use all seven of the Roman numerals, you still have a great emphasis on the 666. There are other ways to go ahead and interpret this, but to me, this makes absolute sense. And it's certainly very, very consistent with the book, because as you think about the Roman numeral system, the first six, 666, it's a way of saying to the Christians, when you look at the civil authority that's in power right now, how's God see it? It's evil. It's opposed to his will. It's like Goliath. So it was a way, I think, of trying to comfort these people and warn them that, you know, don't worry about this. Better times are going to come. There is another quick point, I think, that, well, let me make this point as well. When you think about Rome, would you say in some respects, maybe a limited respect, that it's as bad as a nation can get? What did it do that no other nation has ever done?
Conquered.
Well, some other nations have been conquerors, so let's think back to the time of Jesus, John. What's it done that no other nation has done? All right. Some other nations, they have done some terrible things with genocide. It is an awful thing to go in and gas people. It is an awful thing to crucify people. But when you are the nation that is really responsible for crucifying the Son of God, that puts you in a category that no other nation has ever been in. That was Rome. Jesus was crucified by the power, by the authority of Rome. So when you use its alphabet, it comes up to 666. Now, as I said, I could be wrong, but out of all the explanations that I've seen, and this is an explanation, if you sit through a dozen of the Bible classes, you'll probably not see this. This is something that I've come across within the last year. It was by a guy who's done a lot with biblical numbers. He's got a PhD, and like I say, really smart guy. And to me, this is as close as I think I'm ever going to get to trying to figure out what this is. Another thing I think that's kind of interesting, when we talked about the first six seals, 1 to 6, and then you've got the seventh one out here, and then after the seals, remember John talks about the seven seals, and then the seven trumpets, and then we have the seven plagues, which we haven't started yet. If you'll recall, we said as far as the first six seals, that takes us through the Christian dispensation and up to what point? Christ coming. Same is also true for the trumpets. You know, first 1 through 6, and it really gets us to the end of time, and, you know, John talks about the bad things that are going to happen to God's people, and when we deal with the seven plagues, it's the same thing. The first six throughout the Christian dispensation, and then brings us right up there to the kinds of troubles that the unsaved are going to face at the end of time. So, to me, that's also kind of interesting. You know, three more sixes, and that third six, or that last six for all three, you know, the six trumpets, the six seals, the six plagues. Also, as we look back to those and forward to the plagues, you know, bad news, evil things are going to take place for the people who are not in a right relationship with God. I want to give you a couple of the pieces of information, then we'll stop and see if there's something that you want.
Does this mean 1 to 6 is the Christian age up to Christ's
second coming? Yes, basically throughout the whole Christian dispensation, the first six of each of those items to tell us some of the things that we should expect. There are some other ideas that have been tossed around. You have, for example, a title that's sometimes associated with the Pope. People have taken those Latin alphabet characters and tried to turn them into numbers. And if you do that, you can come up with 666. So there have been various things with Catholicism that you can line up with 666, and that has caused some people to say, aha, it's the Pope, or it is Catholicism, or, you know, it's the apostate church. Once again, you can get 666 out of that, but is that the 666 that John was thinking of? Perhaps. Scott? Yes.
With adding all this up, when it says 1666, they think when it says B man, the B is 1, and then 666 is. You see what I'm saying?
You would think that the 666 is pointing to a specific person?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And one of the examples of that in modern times would be Ronald Reagan. Ronald, how many letters there?
Six.
Remember his middle name? Wilson. How many letters?
Six.
Reagan, how many letters?
Six.
Well, it works for me. I mean, that was kind of, you know, people didn't like Reagan. Well, some did. Some didn't. But people who didn't like Reagan, they would say, aha, you know, 666, and we can't get any better than that. Well, once again, we go back and we look at the present tense in verses 17 and 18. John says, has, is. There had to be some connection to his day and time. Now, for our day and time, as we said, we've got a great way to apply that. We still have evil governments. We still have governments trying to get God's people to do various things that are inconsistent with the Scripture. So, 666 available today? Sure, still it is. Just as John talked about Antichrist in his day and time in the book of 1 John, we still have people and organizations, forces that are opposed to Christ today. So, not new, but you know, I don't want to suck all the wind out of 666, but it's not nearly as frightening as a lot of people have made it out to be. Harvey?
Did the Roman Church come into existence at all, or the Catholic Church come into existence at all?
When it
started?
Yes, you would put it in that part of the world. So hundreds of years went by, Rome collapsed, and probably... Yes, yeah, it would be. And when you think about finally what came out of that, as far as the Roman Empire, the Catholic Church, the Holy Roman Empire finally coming together, there was another period. We have civil authority. I mean, that's why we call it the Dark Ages. They pretty much buried true Christianity and the Bible and persecuted those who wanted to serve God and do what was right.
They were trying to destroy
it. Yes. Yeah. So, once again, Satan very, very good and very interested in using evil civil authority and false religion to get people to do, you know, his will instead of God's will. And it hasn't changed. It's the same stuff. Anybody else? Okay. Well, that's going to close out what I wanted to say over Revelation chapter 13. So let's pick up some introductory remarks for Revelation chapter 14. When we think about where we've been, we've got the mark of the beast that we've talked about there at the end of Revelation chapter 13, the information about the 666 and so forth. So we've got really a lot of the bad folks in Revelation 13. I said earlier, an easy way to remember Revelation 13 and what it talks about is the number 13. We hear people associate the number 13 with bad luck and you know, evil things, and that's largely what we have in Revelation chapter 13. Well, if we've talked about the evil things in Revelation 13, then if John's ready to switch subjects, logically it would make sense for him to now turn to good things. Well, let's see how Revelation 14 verse 1 opens. And I saw and behold, and we're not going to say to the text, but just for the sake of introduction. And I saw and behold the Lamb, he's standing where? He's standing on the Mount, Mount Zion. And with him, how many people are there? 144,000. We'll review what that means next week. And having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads. Well, would we think that these 144,000 with the name of the Father written on the forehead are good folks or bad folks? They're good folks. They're the righteous people. So, because John has finished up with the unrighteous people in Revelation chapter 13, those who are willing to follow the mark of the beast, it's now time to turn to these additional folks. This chapter is somewhat similar to Revelation 12 in that John seems to describe a condensed picture of the entire Christian era. He's going to use the first five verses. We read verse 1. Let's also pick up with verses 2 through 4 to describe the righteous people. He says, "And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And the voice which I heard was as the voice of harpers, harping with their harps. And they sing, as it were, a new song before the throne, and before the four living creatures and the elders. And no man could learn the song save the 144,000, even they that have been purchased out of the earth. These are they that were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they that follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These are they that were purchased from among men to be the first fruits unto God and unto the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no lie. They were without blemish. Then John's going to say in verses 8 through 11, that there is this Babylon, and he has some things to say about that. Babylon, of course, is going to refer to something evil, and we will do our best to interpret that as well. He says, if you follow the ways of Babylon, are you going to do well, or are you going to not do so well? You're not going to fare so well. You're going to perish if you pursue this particular course. Verses 14 through 20, John's going to talk about the harvesting of souls. As the Christian era begins, we talked about this in Revelation 6, 2. Remember, Jesus is pictured as that rider. He's on the white horse. And throughout the Christian era, what's he doing? He's going throughout the earth looking for his people as well as souls to save. Conquering sin. That is the mission that the Lord is on right now. Revelation 7, let's see. What did it do? Got off here a little bit. Yeah, he's pictured as saving souls from sin, Revelation 6, 2. And then in Revelation 7, we saw how God is sealing his people. And in Revelation 7, it says, you know, that wasn't going to stop until each person had been saved that had an interest in salvation. God's going to continue to let the earth stand until those who want to be saved have saved. Just as we would go out, if you've ever picked, sometimes a person will say, we picked the raspberry patch clean. Or we picked the grapevine clean. Well, you know, they mean, if that's literally true, they've gone out there and they've taken every last berry. They've taken every last grape. Well, that's what God's going to do. We see that illustrated in principle in other passages. God is not willing that how many should perish? Any should perish. He doesn't want a person to be lost. So however heaven has set up this particular plan, God is going to make sure that everybody who is interested in salvation does receive it. So these are some of the things that we want to see from Revelation 14. Now, one of the other things that we've not talked about, and we'll see this again in our future study, Revelation 14, John is an interesting writer. We, as we look through 1 John, saw this particular point, you probably don't remember way back when, but I said if you look at 1 John, we're also now seeing this in Revelation, but if you look at 1 John, you find that John used at least 20 different illustrations to compare the saved with the lost. 20 different descriptions or 20 different illustrations. You remember some of those? We can walk in the light or we can walk in the darkness. Can you think of some others? It doesn't have to come from John, but he was really good about these. All right, we've got purity. We've got lack of purity, impurity. We can be righteous or we can be unrighteous. We can be with the saved or we can be with the lost. We can be... All right, good or evil would be another way to designate this. All right, we've got the sheep and the goats as we think about the imagery from Matthew 25. Anything else? Obedient. We've got the disobedience on the other side. Now, as you go back and you start looking at what we read in Revelation chapter 14, and I'm going to give you a little clue to think about. Let's go back and see what we've got in verse 3. Because we've got a couple extra minutes, but I really don't want to dive into Revelation 14, but just to give you a taste. John, as he's describing the song, he says in Revelation 14:3, they sing, as it were, a new song before the throne. Okay, well, that's not hard. And then he says, towards the end of that verse, and no man could learn the song, save the 144,000, or the saved. Do you think that's literally true? I mean, here's a song that only the saved can learn the words to. The unsaved can't learn the words to a song?
They may not be able to learn the meaning.
Hmm?
They may not be able to learn the meaning if they're not a Christian.
Okay, I think that could be one point that you would make. All right, that would be something else. What did we just say about John and 1 John? He gives various descriptions for the saved and the unsaved. And we sometimes will say, well, you know, we know how a person thinks. We know how a person writes. We know even what handwriting is like. I talked to Mom the other day, and my sister has a couple kids, and a girl in the family is about 9, and this year they haven't told the truth about Santa yet. And the girl said, well, hey, Santa's handwriting looks a lot like Dad's handwriting. You know, we're kind of getting to the point where we can kind of figure that thing out. So when we start getting inside the head of somebody and we start having an understanding of what they're doing, if we know that John uses various descriptions to describe the saved and the lost. Think about that in terms of Revelation 14. There are some who know the song. Who are they? The righteous, the saved. There are some who don't know the song. Probably not talking about a literal song and literally understanding the words, but he's saying what with this description? By knowing the song, it's just another way of saying you're among the righteous. By saying you don't know the song, it's another figurative way of saying you're among the unsaved. So, especially as we start getting into this section of Revelation, get inside John's head. Remember that this writer uses all kinds of strange symbols and illustrations to say you are either in this camp or you are in this camp. So it was really helpful to go through 1 John before we studied the book of Revelation. And we'll continue to make this point a few more times as we go through the text. Anybody? Scott?
Would the song be God's word then? Would the song be God's word?
Yeah, that's just getting too far ahead. I don't want to complicate things, but I was going to take a couple minutes to kind of give you a little taste of what we're looking at. So we're just going to put that on hold for next week. Anybody else as far as Mark of the Beast, Revelation 13?
Just note, like in chapter 13, 11, it says, "And I saw a beast coming up out of the earth." Then if you go down at the first part of chapter 14, "But behold, a lamb standing on the mountain. See that beast coming out of the earth, which you have a lamb on top of the mountain."
You got it. Revelation is a series of contrasts. And I'm going to sound like a broken record, but when we look at the Bible, the first 26 books of the New Testament, isn't that by and large what we have? The saved over here, the lost over here. You can obey, you can be part of the church, it just goes all the way down the list. Or you can choose not to do that. Revelation is doing the same kind of thing. You have two choices. You can obey Rome, you can obey the emperors, you can become involved in the apostate religion, or you can do what's right. And it's not a new message. Joshua 24, choose you this day. Way back when, God said you got to make a choice. So throughout time, Adam and Eve, doesn't it even start there? God says you're in the garden. And this is what you need to do to maintain a right relationship with me. You choose this or you choose death. That's how the Bible begins. It's how it ends. And if you can get this in your minds, You may struggle with some of the symbols in Revelation, but you've got the big picture, and that's what you need. We're done today.